Collins. Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Wednesday, May 27th, 2020. There are some developments in social media aimed at trying to control free expression. Some of it is related to our dear tweeter. But the controversy between Trump and Twitter is something that's being widely reported in the mainstream corporate media. So I want to lead with the other, what I consider to be more concerning development in the social media world today. And I didn't find anything about it in my survey of the media outlets that I do on a daily basis, the LA Times, San Francisco Chronicle, New York Times, Washington Post. No, this came from Electronic Intifada. The news that Facebook has hired the former Director General of Israel's Justice Ministry as a member of its new oversight board. Now, this is an attempt to this oversight board is an effort by Facebook to create a structure for what they would consider to be rational censorship. And we've seen how people who offer alternative views about the coronavirus, the lockdowns, and other controversies related to COVID-19 have had videos removed from YouTube. Facebook either blocks their posts or they tag them with what they consider to be offsetting factual information. And they also, without any public transparency, keep people from seeing it by setting the algorithms to essentially ignore it. Well, Emmy Palmer served at the Justice Ministry. She was the former Director General until about a year ago. And if you've seen the Al Jazeera documentary called The Lobby, about how Israel's Justice Ministry had its own budget to fight boycott, divestment, and sanctions movements in the United States, and to otherwise infiltrate and neutralize those who were seen as enemies of the State of Israel because they don't support the extreme right policies of the Netanyahu government. And they consider it, in some cases, an apartheid government. And Facebook has collaborated with Emmy Palmer. It's spelled EMIPALMOR. And the Al Jazeera documentary shows how, from Israel, in violation of our Foreign Agents Registration Act, that she operated through proxies here in the United States. Various youth groups, the Anti-Defamation League, and others. To direct a sweeping effort by Israel to control expression of opinions that Israel doesn't like. And so her appointment to this censorship board at Facebook is deeply troubling. And in the past, Palmore was successful in getting Facebook to muzzle people who are described as human rights defenders, particularly Palestinian, Arab, and Muslim voices on Facebook. So we will watch and wait. But Facebook is descending into a kind of specific form of censorship that is quite un-American. And to me, reprehensible and completely unacceptable. Now to the story that's widely being covered, and the way I frame it is, will Trump shoot himself in the phone? Because, you know, we heard all about the Russian meddling in 2016, but it was the Trump campaign's very successful use of Facebook that allowed it to target using Cambridge Analytica's data and $80-plus million in Trump campaign funds to target racist messages at people who they had identified as racists, for example. So Trump has not been censored or brushed back, to my knowledge, by Facebook recently. But our dear tweeter is really pissed at Jack Dorsey and Twitter. And it's because yesterday they applied a fact-checking tag and essentially declared that a series of Trump tweets attacking mail-in balloting were unsubstantiated. Now, this is such a timid step by Facebook. I'm sorry, by Twitter. And as you know, for over a year now, I have been advocating that they must discipline Trump by suspending him or by terminating his account. But his Twitter base, the mob that follows him online, is now up to 80 million. And that's important for the revenue side at Twitter. So they're trying to do the impossible here, which is to get Trump to accept some restrictions on his tweeting while keeping his base there and generating revenues from it. So Trump is hopping mad, tweeting, of course. Republicans feel that social media platforms totally silence conservatives' voices. Now, this is just so irrational. Trump has enjoyed unfettered access to Twitter, using it to smear people, lie about them, attack them unfairly, to put out his alternative facts, many of which are just so obviously false on their faces. And so he tweeted on, "We will strongly regulate or close them down before we can ever allow this to happen. We saw what they attempted to do and failed in 2016. Yeah, they failed to restrain you and your lies, dude. We can't let a more sophisticated version of that happen again." Now, this is just so idiotic on so many levels. Because maybe there are other conservatives who feel they have been silenced on Twitter, but Trump is not among those victims. And I'm aware of many people who are hard to categorize politically and many people who are easily categorized as leftists who have been disciplined, suspended, or banned for life for trivial comments that were not explained but described as violating the community standards at Twitter. Well, if Trump reflects the limits of community standards at Twitter, the people who I'm aware of who have been disciplined are far from that extreme. Another tweet from the Donald. "Twitter has now shown that everything we have been saying about them and their compatriots is correct. Big action to follow." So what kind of regulation can he put on Twitter? Is it non-regulation? That they must simply accept anything that anybody at any time wants to post? Because I can't imagine any rules that would benefit Trump in the long term. Same on Facebook, where he is once again dumping millions and millions of dollars into that platform to promote with half-truths, shady videos, every tool that's available, a deeply shaded perception of reality, and, of course, frequent attacks on Democrats and perceived enemies using the same ugly toolbox. So the tag by Twitter was that these tweets falsely claim mail-in ballots are fraudulent. Get the facts about mail-in ballots. And they link to articles at CNN, The Washington Post, and The Hill. And a spokesperson, Katie Rosborough, said the presidential tweets contain potentially misleading information about voting processes and have been labeled to provide additional context around mail-in ballots. Well, isn't that sweet? But the uglier thing that Trump is using Twitter for these days are his scurrilous attacks on Joe Scarborough, co-host with his wife Mika Brzezinski of the Morning Joe show on MSNBC. Now, I have never been a fan of Scarborough. You know, he's a former moderate Republican congressman from Florida. And he and Mika just debased themselves in their sycophantic coverage of Trump in 2016. And recordings were released. He'd call into the show because he didn't want to have his hair done to appear on TV early in the day. And, you know, during the commercial breaks, Trump was asking, what are you going to ask me next? And when they told him, he said, oh, let's not go there. And they said, okay. And so they just puffballed him in the extreme. And his attacks, and Trump has admitted on Twitter that he skillfully used Joe and Mika in 2016, and now that's over. And so he's been gunning for Scarborough, and he makes this claim that Scarborough was responsible for the death of a woman on his congressional staff almost 20 years ago. And the widower of the woman has said, look, she died of a heart issue. Joe wasn't there, didn't have anything to do with it. And Trump intimates that there was an affair going on between Scarborough and the woman. And Twitter doesn't do a damn thing about that. Now, there's absolutely no evidence to support what Trump is asserting. But the standards over there at Twitter are indecipherable. And yeah, you know, I look at Twitter. Usually in the morning, there are these alerts that have piled up on my phone after night. But I don't spend any time there because I don't find it useful. It's just a bunch of people squabbling with each other, strutting like they're all know-it-alls. And there are many pissing contests. So now Trump and his allies have focused on an individual employee over at Twitter. And because on his personal account, he has posted things that people discovered that were pretty critical of Trump. The guy's name is Yoel Roth, and somebody dug up one of his old tweets where he said, I'm just saying we fly over the states that voted for a racist tangerine for a reason, and yes, that person in the pink hat is clearly a bigger threat to your brand of feminism than the actual Nazis in the White House. Well, Yoel Roth is the head of site integrity. And so they're assuming that he was responsible. Twitter says they've got the wrong guy, that this decision was made by a committee, and they don't really explicitly say whether Yoel Roth sat in on those meetings or not. But they issued this statement, no one person at Twitter is responsible for our policies or enforcement actions, and it's unfortunate to see individual employees targeted for company decisions. Now, maybe he is responsible. I think the buck stops with Jack Dorsey. And if Trump wants to send his minions of mob hysteria on Twitter after somebody, I think the CEO and founder is the guy who deserves the heat. And the New York Times takes a little delight in recapping right-wing media as it recoils from Trump's smear of Scarborough. The New York Post, described as Trump's first read in the morning, that is a Murdoch paper, lamented in an editorial Tuesday that the president decided to suggest that a TV morning show host committed murder. That is a depressing sentence to type. Trust us, they say to Trump, you did not look like the bigger man. Then the Washington Examiner. Vile, they declared it. His attacks are incompatible with leadership. The Wall Street Journal, slightly more elegant. They called Trump's unfounded accusation against Scarborough ugly even for him. We don't write this with any expectation that Trump will stop. Perhaps he even thinks this helps him politically, though we can't imagine how. But Trump is debasing his office, and he's hurting the country in doing so. By the way, the woman who died, Lori Klausutis, was a staff member back in the congressional office. She died in 2001 when a heart condition caused her to fall and hit her head on a desk. So that's all I know about the case. But the way Trump is playing it is just so calculated and strange. Now, he continues his tirade against mail-in balloting, and now California is the target. And for those outside the Golden State, can I just let you know that I'm the guy who goes to the polls because it's a ritual I enjoy. But everybody I know votes by mail. And in the March primary, 72% of the votes were absentee ballots. And the governor has ordered that every registered voter be sent a mail-in ballot for the November election as a, safety measure because of the virus. And this offends Trump, who just goes bonkers, right? The governor of California is sending ballots to millions of people. Anyone living in the state, no matter who they are or how they got there, will get one. This will be a rigged election. No way. Now, Trump doesn't have a prayer of carrying California. So why does he care? He has already lost California, no matter what kind of balloting is used. And the idea that there is rampant voter fraud is a fiction. And I will support Twitter. I think they're lame to limit it to that, but they are correct to call it false. Another tweet. Oh, actually, this is a statement from the Republican National Committee. California Democrats have proven more than once they're willing to use this pandemic to implement illegal changes to elections in their state. Newsom's executive order is a brazen and unconstitutional power grab. But number one, they can mail ballots to all kinds of people. It's when they are returned that they get checked against the registration rolls and that signatures are checked, which I think is a little... it's not as secure as it could be, but, if somebody doesn't know how a person's voter registration form was signed, an effort to copy that signature is probably going to fail. And so if a dead person tries to vote and their name isn't on the rolls, if you have other people filling out the ballots, there is still that measure of who signs off on the envelope. And so this is just more hysteria generated by Trump. And they quote one law professor in the San Francisco Chronicle article about it, that it appears he is laying the grounds to say that the election was rigged if he loses. But this is a pretty lame effort, particularly here in California. Then we learn that there is quite an infrastructure behind this effort to restrict mail-in voting. And guess who's involved? The Koch brothers, and one of them died, but we still call them the Koch brothers. Betsy DeVos's family, that's Rich DeVos, the Amway fortune. And it's now called, Orwellianly, the Honest Elections Project. But it used to be called the Judicial Education Project, and it's a dark money conservative group. It's already dropped $250,000 in advertisements in April warning against voting by mail, accusing Democrats of cheating. And I'll remind you that the most recent case of harvesting of absentee ballots was a scheme by Republican operatives in North Carolina that led even North Carolina to call that election void and run a replacement election. This project is closely linked to Leonard Leo, one of the most powerful people in Washington. And, of course, this is the same group that was behind the Supreme Court picks of Brett Kavanaugh and Neil Gorsuch. So Trump's tweeting is not accidental. It's stupid. But it is part of a larger orchestrated effort. A good piece by Gabriella Novella. She is the election integrity reporter at Who, What, Why. And I interviewed her for a podcast over at Who, What, Why that was posted last week. And she notes that back in 2018, voters in Florida overwhelmingly approved a constitutional amendment, number 4, which restored voting rights to individuals with past felony convictions automatically upon the completion of their sentence. But Republicans saw 1 million potential Democratic votes, and they look for ways to block it. Yes, suppression is their systematic approach to elections wherever possible. So, on Sunday, federal judge Robert Hinkle ruled that a provision in a new law, which was intended to block most of these people from voting, where the law required that they have to pay any and all outstanding legal fees, fines, or restitution before their rights can be restored. Well, it turns out that 8 out of 10 of these people with past felony convictions who become eligible to vote still owe some money, more than $500, in legal obligations. So, this was a way to really frustrate the will of voters and find a way to block these ex-felons from participating. And the people who brought a lawsuit that the judge ruled in favor of called this a modern-day poll tax. They just forgot to mention Jim Crow. Well, I want to mention that I received last night a request for a grant from the Peter B. Collins Podcast Community Fund. The email comes from Caroli Bozen, who is located in North Royalton, Ohio. He says that's about a half hour south of Cleveland. And with his wife, Irene, they are both retired high school teachers. Their home is a little farm south of Cleveland. They grow organic produce to supply the family with healthy food. He says, we don't have much money, but we make do. What we lack in finances, we more than make up for with the love and affection we get from our kids and grandkids. But he said that times are tough and money is tight, and $100 could make a difference. So I wrote back and I said, happy to send you a check, but let me ask you, since you're growing fresh vegetables, do you have enough produce to share with others in your area? So I offered to send him $200 if he would share food with two or three families who are hitting the wall themselves and can't afford fresh food. It's not available at the dollar store, you know. So Caroli wrote back, you succeeded in surprising us. Absolutely. We will share our peppers and tomatoes and everything else with our neighbors in need. We will have many different vegetables in abundance by July and August. And if I happen to be in the area, he would welcome me to stop by. I don't plan to be in Northern Ohio this summer. Caroli, I'm not sure exactly how you pronounce your name. But I think this is a great exchange because you'll get extra cash. It's kind of an indirect barter effort. And you can share the intention of me and my listeners to help people who are having a hard time because of the impending depression and the impacts of COVID-19. So if you can use a grant or someone you know you want to nominate, all you have to do is drop me an email, peter@peterbcollins.com. We have plenty of funds. I'm not asking, putting out any requests for new donations until we get close to handing out what we already have. But just address that email to peter@peterbcollins.com. And as you can see, we have not turned down any requests. So you're aware now that the ugly history has repeated itself. You remember how Staten Island cops took down Eric Garner in a chokehold. And he was a big black man who had offended the officers because he was selling individual cigarettes to make a little money to jingle in his pocket. And Eric Garner was quoted by passersby as repeatedly saying, I can't breathe. So this played out again the other day in Minneapolis. And for the best coverage of this, I would invite you to follow the link in my show file to Mint Press News and its excellent reporter, Alan McLeod. Mint Press and Manar Mahawish are based in Minneapolis, St. Paul. And they identify the cop who was seen with his knee on the neck of 46-year-old African-American George Floyd. And echoing Eric Garner, Floyd kept saying, "I can't breathe." And Officer Chauvin, Derek Chauvin, was seen with his knee and nonchalantly his hands in his pockets, like he was just waiting for his suspect to pass out. And the details I know of the case are that George Floyd was suspected to have been involved in some kind of forgery. He was forcibly extracted from his car, and apparently there's another video of that. But as he was held in this, he had handcuffs on, he was not armed, he was on the ground and his body appeared to be partially under the police SUV. And people who were watching this and videotaping it said, "You're fucking stopping his breathing there, bro." Now, Chauvin, according to this report, has killed multiple times before while in interview, in uniform. He has shot and wounded others and is well known to local activist groups. And then they shift the focus to Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar, who was running for president in this cycle. And she issued what they describe here as a very tepid statement, describing the police killing of an unarmed black man over an alleged forged check as merely an officer-involved shooting. Now, there was no shooting. This was a brutal death by asphyxiation. Klobuchar also called for a complete and thorough outside investigation into what occurred, and those involved in this incident must be held accountable, she said sternly. But McLeod writes, this is unlikely to occur in no small part because of Klobuchar herself and the precedent she set while serving as the state's chief prosecutor between 1999 and 2007. In that time, she declined to bring charges against more than two dozen officers who had killed citizens while on duty, including the same guy, Chauvin, who shot and killed Wayne Reyes in 2006 and would later go on to shoot more civilians while in uniform. And during that same time, Klobuchar was ramping up the number of arrests as part of her tough-on-crime agenda, something which inordinately affected people of color. In her first year in office alone, the prison sentences for first-degree drug crimes doubled. Activists allege her embracing of the broken window style, that's Mike Bloomberg policing, was a deliberate strategy. And in one case, a man named El Said Salim was convicted of failing to declare a secondary income that enabled him this, you know, by not declaring that, he qualified for welfare and food stamps. And a judge sentenced him to exactly 364 days in jail, deliberately attempting to protect him from deportation. An outraged Klobuchar appealed the decision, lobbying for an upgrade, condemning the state's judges for letting offenders off the hook too easily, and Salim was subsequently deported. And family members of George Floyd, including his sister Bridget, were interviewed today. And about the event on Monday, she says they should be in jail for murder. We will be watching. Meanwhile, on the coronavirus front, France has announced that it is revoking the authorization for allowing hydroxychloroquine as a treatment for COVID-19 patients, a day after halting the use of the malaria drug in clinical trials. Don't tell Trump. And now to our daily COVID-19 report prepared by Linda Lewis. Worldwide, 352,000 deaths now are attributed to the coronavirus. In the United States, the official count is just under 100,000, But media estimates show that it exceeded 100,000 sometime yesterday. And because many areas issued moratoria on evictions during the shutdown in so many jurisdictions, the New York Times is warning of a wave of evictions as government relief payments and legal protections run out for millions of out-of-work Americans who have little financial cushion and few choices when they look for new housing. Evictions will soon be allowed in about half of the states, and some have already begun in Texas and in Oklahoma. In a survey released this month by the Census Bureau, nearly a quarter of respondents said they missed their last rent or mortgage payment and have little to no confidence they'll be able to pay on time next month. And of course, with the, you know, deferred payments still due at some point, these people are, well, they are going to be squeezed in many cases into homelessness. A quote from the Times, "This means more and more families may soon experience the dreaded eviction notice on the front door, the stomach-turning knock from the sheriff's deputies, the possessions piled up on the sidewalk. They will face displacement at a time when people are still being urged to stay at home. And it'll put them at greater risk for infection." Linda also notes that the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission is reminding Americans that EEO laws, including the Americans with Disabilities Act, continue to apply during the COVID-19 pandemic. They do not interfere with or prevent employers from following the guidelines and suggestions made by the CDC or state and local public health authorities about steps that employers should take regarding COVID-19. Anyone who is working or applying for work should read these documents, and we'll link to them in the show file for today's podcast. COVID-19 has vastly expanded the number of workers covered by disabilities laws to include individuals with existing conditions that would make you vulnerable to the coronavirus. And EEOC guidance covers a variety of topics with important implications for employee rights and safety. For example, what inquiries employers can make about your existing medical condition and when they can require medical testing and more. So I think that is an important area. And I have a friend who was working at a car wash. The car wash was shut down. They're now reopening it, and they've asked her to come back to work. But her job is to be the greeter who interacts with every person who pulls up and rolls down their window and says, "Yeah, you know, I want the wax too." And because of her health conditions, she is not quitting, but she is trying to delay reporting back to work. When Trump came into office, they were intent on cutting regulations. And during the Obama years, it took 6 years, a new rule was added to a list of regulations scheduled for implementation in 2017 under the protection of workers over at OSHA. But the incoming Trump administration abandoned it after boasting the never-ending growth of red tape in America has come to a sudden screeching and beautiful halt. You remember Trump said that for every new regulation, he would eviscerate two. Well, he's eviscerated hundreds, if not thousands, of regulations. But I don't know of any new ones that went into effect. At a Rose Garden news conference yesterday, Trump again undermined efforts of public health officials to persuade Americans to wear masks in public spaces. He asked reporter Jeff Mason to remove his mask. "Can you take it off? Because I can't hear you." And Mason said, "I'll just speak louder, sir." And Trump said derisively, "Oh, yeah, because you want to be politically correct. Go ahead." Two excellent pieces, both published in the Guardian from Britain today, under the byline of David Sirota. One is a news article which offers facts about how Governor Cuomo of New York took bundles of campaign cash from the hospital and nursing home industries for his reelection to a third term in 2018. And then in the budget bill that was tightly controlled by Cuomo and his top aides because the legislature wasn't able to meet when it passed, They slipped in the nation's most explicit immunity protections for healthcare industry officials. And while recently I've heard Cuomo tell Rachel Maddow about these dastardly nursing home operators, his comments don't matter to them because they cannot be sued. And we also saw more than 5,000 New Yorkers statewide die in nursing homes. And Cuomo's critics say he has taken a hands-off approach to regulating the healthcare industry interests that helped to bankroll his election campaign. In March, Cuomo's administration issued an order that allowed nursing homes to readmit sick patients without testing them for COVID-19. And amid allegations of undercounted casualties, the governors also pushed back against pressure to have state regulators more stringently record and report deaths in nursing homes. So it's a good piece, and he cites Professor Nina Cohn, a law professor at Syracuse University, who says that New York is an outlier, has the most explicit and sweeping immunity language. And she said, granting immunity sends a terrible message for the future. The industry gets caught with its pants down during the crisis, and now we're telling them they don't even have to wear pants. The other piece by Sirota is described as an op-ed, an opinion piece, and it builds on what I linked to you yesterday, Jimmy Dore's powerful interview with Matt Taibbi and Katie Halper at Rolling Stone. And also the comments that you heard on my most recent podcast with the young activists Andrew Perez and Adam Eichen. And it is a sharp critique of the so-called Democratic progressives, because the leadership of the party is busy undermining the policy goals and agenda of the progressive wing of the party and kind of saying, take that, Bernie Sanders and all of your bros. And Sirota adds details to what I discussed with Eichen and Perez, that the Democrats, while they did get some good language and benefits into the original CARES Act, that the elements that they wrote for the HEROES Act that has passed the House and appears to be kryptonite over in the Senate, well, as Eichen and Perez pointed out, the lending program, the PPP for small nonprofits, was redefined to allow the trade and lobby groups of America's biggest corporations to go up to the trough and grab some money. Then, after Trump himself suggested he wanted the government to pay health care providers directly for treating uninsured COVID-19 patients, the Democrats shifted that money into COBRA. And that's the very expensive program. When your employer lays you off, you can still get that health insurance you were carrying, but you've got to pay for all of it, and it's really expensive. And that is a sop to the for-profit health insurance industry. There's more in Sirota's piece, and I encourage you to read it. Also, those ultra-progressive Democrats under the leadership of Nancy Pelosi are voting this afternoon, and it's unclear if there are enough votes to pass the three bills that will extend the FISA courts and the FISA law. Now, what's fascinating here is that because Trump is pissed at the FISA court for allowing the continued warrants against Carter Page, and that has been exposed as wrongdoing by the FBI, he is urging Republicans to vote against the bill. Now, it's already passed the Senate, and so this is the last stop. Now, aside from Trump's personal interest in the FISA court, what's interesting here is that if Republicans do line up and vote against the bill, then it will be Pelosi and her Democrats who extend the life of a bill that allows the president, with his new staunch supporter running the director of National Intelligence Office, to use and abuse the intelligence apparatus against his political enemies. This is just plain fucking stupid. I haven't seen it yet, but there's a four-part series on Netflix streaming now which is called Jeffrey Epstein, Filthy Rich. And I've read some reviews here. It appears it focuses on his victims and on his one-time girlfriend who became his pimp, Ghislaine Maxwell, who has escaped any investigation or any accountability for her role in the systematic exploitation of underage girls. So I'm curious. I will try to watch it in the next few days, or at least one episode, and see if it gets beyond the tabloid level of sensationalizing his sex crimes. Will it expose his believed extortion of Leslie Wexner, the guy who owned Victoria's Secret and The Limited, and who gave Epstein carte blanche over his fortune? This is priceless, and what you're about to hear is an excerpt from a series of local television news programs that were sent video footage and a script by the PR department at Amazon. And I want to note that you've heard clips like this in the past that are part of the Sinclair television station network, and they have central control over their local news programs. They give their local news anchors scripts that they are required to read verbatim. But in this case, it wasn't Sinclair management. Apparently only one Sinclair station is among the 11 that fell for this propaganda campaign run by Amazon's PR department. And they were trying to burnish their image as a safe workplace after there were walkouts and they fired the guy in Long Island who was a leader of those asking for safer working conditions in the Amazon minimum wage warehouse operations. So listen to this. As clip to clip, you will hear these different anchors reading the exact same script as what we call B-roll, pictures that were supplied by Amazon about their super clean and healthy warehouse operations were rolling behind the voiceover.
Of Americans staying at home are relying on Amazon.
Millions of Americans staying at home are relying on Amazon.
Millions of Americans staying at home are relying on Amazon.
Millions of Americans staying at home are relying on Amazon.
Amazon has transformed its operations in response to COVID-19 to protect employees and keep packages flowing.
Amazon has transformed its operations in response to COVID-19 to protect employees and keep packages flowing.
The company is keeping its employees safe and healthy while still delivering those packages to your doorstep.
The company is keeping employees safe and healthy.
The company is keeping its employees safe and healthy.
The company is keeping its employees safe and healthy.
The company is keeping its employees safe and healthy.
The company is keeping its employees safe and healthy.
The company is keeping its employees safe and healthy. The company is keeping its employees safe and healthy.
It spent $800 million on increased wages and overtime pay during the pandemic.
It has spent $800 million on increased wages and overtime.
Now, most of these are smaller markets. I saw Palm Springs. Where's WTVM? I'm not sure. Anyway, this is a cheesy stunt. Number one, it shows that local stations are so cheap and so lazy that when a big company like Amazon feeds them a script and footage, they don't even bother to rewrite it. They just deliver it verbatim. And Amazon has stressed that they didn't pay the stations to do this. They just gave it to them. And we used to call these VNRs, video news releases. And you can't get the big stations in the big cities to play ball with you. But when there are only two people, an anchor and a reporter, on a shift in a local TV newsroom, these kinds of corners will be cut, and savvy PR people know all about it and how to exploit it. Yesterday, I was sharing with you the important investigative reporting of Ben Norton at the Gray Zone, exposing how The Intercept bungled its investigation of reality winners, leaks of classified information, and she wound up with more than a five-year prison sentence. And Kevin Gostola, over at Shadowproof, details the efforts by Reality Winner's lawyers to get her released on a compassionate basis to home confinement. She has served more than half of her 63-month sentence. She's got 19 months remaining. But the Justice Department and the judge claim that the prison where she is has great medical facilities and that she's probably better off there. I mean, this is just so disingenuous. And just like Chelsea Manning was given the contempt citation that put her back in prison for almost, I think it was over a year, and then a $400,000 fine. This is true injustice aimed at whistleblowers. When people like Michael Cohen and other connected grifters, like Paul Manafort, can get favorable consideration for early release from a federal court. And I've seen a lot of noise coming out of Detroit because Kwame Kilpatrick, who was their deeply corrupt mayor, and who was convicted and sentenced to 27 years in federal prison. He served about a third of that, 7 years, and he applied for the same kind of release. Now, I know that Detroiters are really pissed at Kwame. But how different is his case from Paul Manafort or Michael Cohen? Michael Cohen hasn't served a third of his term. Paul Manafort has not served a third of his term. Maybe you need to know that Kwame Kilpatrick is black. A week ago, I reported, based on the Murdoch New York Post, about the highly edited phone call between Joe Biden and the former president of Ukraine, Petro Poroshenko. Now, Poroshenko was in office, and he told in this, like I say, heavily edited phone call, he told Biden that he had fired the prosecutor because Biden demanded it, and Biden said, "We'll cough up the $1 billion so that I promised you." And I haven't seen a single other report about that, even to, you know, explore whether the edited audio and video are accurate. Interesting how the media is protecting Joe Biden. And finally today, this is not news, but it is confirmation. The Trump Republican tax cuts that were rammed through at the end of 2017, we were told would stimulate the economy, increase wages, lead to more hiring, and bring home offshore capital. Well, some offshore capital came home because of lower tax rates. And then that money was stuffed into the pockets of executives, used to buy back stock to make those executives even wealthier. And it didn't change the trajectory of the economy, which continued on the growth phase that started during the Obama administration. And another failure of the Democrats that I've pointed out recently is that to pay for the coronavirus relief packages, they should be proposing repeal of those 2017 tax cuts. But they don't, because I guess too many of them benefit from them. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. You're free to share it all over the place. You'll find it on YouTube. I remain Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.